This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. What a week for FC Cincinnati and its new stadium in the West End. We learned that there are concerns from Music Hall that noise from the stadium could be intrusive during performances, and the Cincinnati Ballet is concerned about the future of a parking lot that it leases and is now negotiating a solution. The look of the stadium has also changed, and there's debate over the closure of a major artery through downtown Cincinnati during FC Cincinnati games. Here to break it down, our WVXU reporter, Jay Hanselman. Welcome, Jay.
Hi there.
We've got Business Courier reporter Chris Wetterick. Thanks, Chris.
Hello.
And Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. Welcome, Sharon.
Hello.
We'll also be talking to you, so give us a call. We know you want to weigh in on this. It's 513-419-7100. You can also email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter looking for your comments and your tweets, some of which could be shared during this broadcast. Okay, guys, it's the weekly news review. This is the end of my first week as host of this show. Historically, I've been on the other side of the table with you all talking about the news of the week, and I was really looking forward to being the host of this for the first time, talking to you all, until this topic became soccer. And now it's all we can talk about today, because what a week for soccer.
When you have to separate out, it's not really about soccer per se. It's the extracurricular activities.
Sure. I am a big fan of zoning and that sort of thing. So I think we'll have some fun. So Jay, let's start with you. It wasn't all drama this week. Some business related to this stadium, this FC Cincinnati Stadium, was conducted. The team reached a deal of some sort with the city. What are some of the details that you can share with us on that?
Well, there were a couple of things that were actually approved. A committee approved the zoning change, which sets up a planned development that will allow the soccer stadium to be built. Although that passed out of committee, it did not get voted on in the full council, which would come next week. And I would say that apparently that's not even guaranteed that's going to get approved next week. And then the team also needs a police department parking lot behind District 1 for the project. And the team had said that in previous negotiations that they believed that they could buy that from the city for a dollar. Some council members objected and said, no, we want the full appraised value. And again, now there is a deal on paper for that to be sold for more than appraised value. And again, it's not certain that the votes are there for that either. For a project, the thing that I'm struck by, for a project that is under construction, supposed to be coming out of the ground, it seems to me to be a hot mess right now.
Yeah, this is a tough one. Chris,
go ahead. It's really under demolition, right? They can't build anything. They can't actually come up from the ground until they get all these approvals that they need, more or less, right? I mean, that's kind of the situation we're in, and they don't have the votes for those approvals, I don't think, at this moment. We have 5 days until the vote potentially could be held. So there's a lot of behind-the-scenes meetings going on, and we'll see what happens.
What does the handicapping of those votes look like, Sharon? Any idea at
City
Hall?
They do not have the votes right now. Everyone agrees.
Do we know what the number is?
The list of things that you read at the beginning, it's too much.
Yeah.
Like, they want some agreement on these things, and that's like a separate negotiation here, then one here, another here, and no one is willing, basically, to say, I'm all for this, even though there's a lot of issues. I mean, at the very least, for optics, they have to be like, no, we're not going to do this right now until you guys work things out.
Well, let's dive into some of those issues.
Well, before we pass on the vote, let's set the stage, though, for the votes. There are 9 council members. One of those council members has had to recuse himself.
That'd be Vice Mayor Smitherman.
From voting, because his brother owns a concrete company that is going to do concrete work on the new stadium. So he ethically has recused himself from voting. So we start with 8 council members to vote.
And of those 8, 4 of them have been pretty much hard nosed on every FC Cincinnati vote that has come up. So that leaves you with a situation where FC Cincinnati has to persuade one of the hard nosed to come over and vote for this.
Except they may have to persuade 2 of them to come over, because this is an emergency ordinance, and it takes 6 votes to approve the emergency clause for an emergency ordinance. And 5 won't do that. And if they don't get the 6th vote, it won't take effect for 30 days. And there's an outside chance that if diehard opponents are truly against building the stadium, they could try to referendum the ordinance, and that would put it on the ballot if they were successful to collect signatures.
It's called soccer math.
I was going to say.
It's like its own thing now. Kids are going to start learning it in like fourth grade.
See, we're talking about soccer, and now we're talking about math. I'm doomed today, so you guys may have to step up and take over.
My head is spinning at the thought of a referendum on any of this.
Don't say that out loud.
It's not impossible because when they passed the infrastructure money in April, a group tried to suggest a referendum for that, except it was under Ohio law, you cannot file a referendum for an emergency ordinance or an ordinance that appropriates money. That one in April had the emergency provision because one of the council members who voted against passage for the ordinance ended up voting yes on the emergency clause. It's a separate vote, which could happen this time. But I think there's been a lot more ill will between April and now concerning this that they might settle in and play hardball.
Referendum a zoning change like that?
It's the property sale.
Oh, the property sale part of it. Okay.
So two things. First of all, this is super important right now because you would be like, well, the stadium's supposed to open for the 2021 season, which is, not now. However, it takes a long time to build the stadium. There's a very specific building schedule. And that we heard in Planning Commission that there were, there's penalties. If the stadium does not open on time, the team faces, a lot of penalties that seem like they're probably more expensive.
From the league?
Than working these things out right now. From the league, yes.
Okay. All right. So I'm hearing referendum. I mean, are you suggesting then that there may be a possibility that the voters of the entire city would be voting on this?
Well, that's what a referendum. I mean, literally, you can, if an ordinance doesn't pass with an emergency clause, if a group of citizens wanted to collect signatures, they could. Now, they have 30 days to do it. I'm not saying that it's an easy process, but it's not impossible. There have been referendums in the city before, and it is out there that if they don't pass this as an emergency ordinance, that if – and, again, in April when the infrastructure money was approved, a group suggested a referendum then, and they couldn't do it because it was an emergency ordinance. So the thought is probably out there that this is something that they could do if they wanted to try.
I also have to say that back in April, there was a lot of tut-tutting about referendum, and they just – they flat out failed to gather the signatures. It's not particularly well that group at that time was not well organized. Unless there was some sea change where somebody brought in some money and paid some signature gatherers, I just don't see it happening.
All right, let's talk a little bit more. Oh yeah, Sharon, go ahead.
I do want to make the point that we are talking like these. We're saying things like the ballet and the symphony. We're actually talking about the most powerful people in the city.
Right.
Carl Lindner III owns the soccer team. Like when we saw people on behalf of the ballet and the symphony, these are, they're big donors, that we paid a lot of money to renovate Music Hall. They're very concerned about the sound in there. We, the ballet is, if you look at its board. So these people, they have the council members' ears. And so these stakeholders, they're big stakeholders.
And they all raise money from these folks. And so I think they are going to be very, very insistent upon an agreed resolution between FC Cincinnati and the arts organizations and their donors, because they don't want to, they don't want to get crossways politically with either group. And they're not going to want to take a vote one against the other. So
does any – and I'm going to – I get to ask a question now. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, I'm just wondering, though, I'm sitting here thinking about, that these are donors, but there's also six council members who are term limited and can't run again.
Right.
Does that play into it?
I think most politicians – and I think if we broke it down, we could say who's going to run for something else in their life and who's not. And, I think the majority probably think that they will run for something else again, of the majority of the majority that they need. So – I think their ears will be open.
If you want to weigh in, give us a call, 513-419-7100. Email talk@wvxu.org. Check us out on Facebook or Twitter. We'll be looking for your comments and your tweets there. Let's dive into some of these issues that are causing these conversations and complex situations here downtown in the West End and OTR. The first big hurdle we heard about this week was noise, right? I feel like this reminds me a little bit of high school, like it's the jocks versus the arts kids all of a sudden. So I'm not sure exactly which side I'm supposed to fall on anymore. But Chris, what did we learn about the noise this week?
So the companies that perform in Music Hall, the opera, the symphony, the ballet and the May Festival, they commissioned a study and they kind of dropped it in the media's lap late. Was that Tuesday or Monday night?
Monday
I can't
night.
Remember.
Monday night at my bedtime.
Yeah. I was still up. Sherry. Yeah, Sherry's a morning person. I'm a night person. So I was.
I got up.
I was raring to go when I got this thing. So basically it said that the crowd noise and any concerts that they might have at the stadium, that they would be able to hear noise from that in Music Hall during a performance. And that's obviously of great concern because of the reasons that Sherry mentioned, how much money had been spent to rehabilitate Music Hall. The reason for that apparently is that the roof is kind of thin, and that's how it's going to infiltrate in there. And there's a great debate amongst people over – you know, how much noise it actually is, right? The mayor had a little tiff with Vice or Councilman David Mann during council meeting on Wednesday night, saying basically, oh, it's a pin drop, and you know, it's the sound of a light bulb. And Councilman Mann said, well, Mayor, I don't think you understand the science of decibels. And I don't know that we need to go into that, but basically Mann said, noted the science of it and said, it's actually a lot, you know, it's going to be significantly more than those two sounds that you pointed out.
It was a lot more math. It was a big study.
Now we're in science. So you we've know, got soccer, they, math, and science.
They did drop it when they dropped it because they realized that there was like the committee vote to kind of move this forward to full council. And they decided to bring their issue into the public conversation. Before that, it was a draft study. They did the actual testing in December. So you could, like, if you're familiar with, like, this kind of study, like, it's not done yet. But so they kind of rushed a draft in. And there's, like, big X's in it, which is how I write my stories, like, when I don't have the answers to things. Like, XXX. Right. It's, like, solutions, XXX. And it's, like, we do expect a final draft next week. And I assume they're going to fill in the blank where those X's go.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. FC Cincinnati competed to a draw with DC United on Thursday. But back home, questions about the team's future digs remain. We continue now with our conversation about the trouble facing the FC Cincinnati Soccer Stadium. Joining us are WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Welcome back, Jay. Business Courier reporter Chris Wetterick. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. Welcome back, Sharon. And if you want to weigh in, give us a call, 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org. Comment on Facebook or tweet at us. We'll be looking for those as well. So the Cincinnati Ballet is also upset about something, Sharon.
The ballet,
several things.
Yeah, they've been making their case publicly for a couple months now. They are a tenant of FC Cincinnati. They've been a long time there, kind of adjacent to the stadium site, and they were a tenant of land that the team acquired. And the team, you know, it seems like everything is going to go forward. They have a lease. They'll continue. It's like their practice facility, and their parking lot. Well, lo and behold, renderings come out, and there's no more parking lot. The ballet has been very upset about that. The team, you know, says it's offered them some things they feel are comparable and comply with the lease, but this has become a very public fight that involves an attorney for the ballet.
Oh, man. And one thing that happened last night is the ballet's attorney – this was significant because it was the first time that the ballet had urged council to reject the plan development and zoning changes that are needed. They wrote that in a letter last night through their attorney. And so that was a significant move. Up until then, they had said, no, you know, we're working with them. Everybody's working together. We're trying to come up with a solution. But, you know, they kind of pulled the trigger on that last night. So that's a significant move, probably affecting some of the votes that we're talking about this morning.
We got an email from Steve in Oakley. He says, FC Cincinnati Stadium is a classic example again of an endeavor fueled by the fumes of community sports exuberance and elected officials wanting to leave a legacy project rather driven by empirical facts. Compound this with an urban renewal policy dictated by a sports league, and this is what you get. We've also got a phone call. Shar is on the line. Shar, what's your question?
Well, it's not a question as much as it's just another thing to consider, which is that driving the piles for the stadium will probably vibrate all the historic structures in the area. And especially with Music Hall just recently refurbished, it's an old building, it's a masonry building, it may really affect it, you know, the... you know, just the integrity of the building. And I don't know if anyone's looked at that, but it might be something to consider.
Thank you for the feedback, Shar. Okay, so it's not just noise, it's not just ballet. There's a police memorial component to this as well. Who wants to weigh in on that? Sharon?
That kind of bubbled up on social after the land deal was announced, because the land deal calls for to take the parking lot it needs for the stadium site, then the team has to build a parking lot, you know, across the street another way from District 1. And that's where the police memorial is. And this building that we're in, actually, they have to do a lot of reconfiguring for it, and that's where they're going to put the police vehicles that park there. But the police memorial is there. It's a lovely little park across the street, and, you know, it's for our fallen officers, and people are asking what's going to happen to that. And the answer is they're not taking it down, but the question is, should it move? I mean, right now it's next to a lovely little park. Should it be next to a parking lot? And how big is that parking lot going to be?
And I think that's something else that that could be an issue, too, because that is a city park. And I think the park board would have to approve transferring that to another use. And so that's another hurdle that may have to – it may be
– just what we need, another governmental body involved in this thing.
It may be a rubber stamp from the park board, but I think
– which is independent, though, to be fair. Like, that's not – like, they don't answer to council.
So it could be yet another government agency that gets involved to say, yeah, we have to bless this before it happens.
Chris, so the design of the stadium itself has kind of changed a little bit, too. What can you tell us?
Significantly, they've kind of scaled back the development that they were planning to build around it. They had kind of some buildings that would face Central Parkway. They've moved some of those back, and basically the only additional development they have is kind of in that ballet parking lot, kind of in the northeast corner of the site. One thing they've done is they've removed the orange colored roof. Not that there's not going to be kind of an awning over the crowd. There still is going to be that, but the orangeness of it is out. And so, you know, they've kind of also put a plaza facing Central Parkway. So when you drive down Central Parkway, it'll be really evident that there is a stadium there. I think before that, the buildings that they had planned to build at some point, you know, were kind of going to mask the stadium itself.
Why did the orange go away?
Good question. I don't
cost.
Know.
There were they some. They said cost, but you know what? I do feel like since that they said that publicly at a meeting and talked a little bit about it afterwards about the cost and everything, you know, it's kind of become more clear that the stadium, the design is not done yet. It doesn't need to be done, to be fair, to have this vote come in. All you think that it would be, but that's actually not how it works. And this design, it's morphing right now.
And so, that's let me jump in on the design not being done. What if council, when council votes on this, they are they're voting only on a preliminary design, and this is their last chance to weigh in on the city council's last chance to weigh in on the design. The final design, the final development agreement, that's all tasked to the City Planning Commission. So that's probably why there's a little bit of hesitation too, because this is council's last chance to, you know, give their say, have their input, and then they turn it over to the City Planning Commission, who has the final say.
And someday down the road, if there are problems, it's either going to be wonderful, or if there's problems, whatever happens, people are going to be like that council. They're not going to be like, remember that Planning Commission and all those people that were on it? Like, right. You know, it's going to come back to this if you think about what happens with the other stadiums. Like, we know all the names of those commissioners a long time ago.
Right.
Because they are, you know, they're in the spotlight still for what happened with the other stadiums.
All right, let's go. In particular, right?
Let's go back to the phone. Steve is on the line. What's up, Steve?
Hello. I was wondering if there could be a way to share scheduling among all the different parties concerned to, you know, take turns on the scheduling so that everyone could have their say.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Any feedback on that?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the things they're going to talk about. The, you know, the number of dates that overlap was actually a little bit fewer than I thought when somebody did the comparison. I don't remember the exact number, but, I think that's one of the things. I mean, obviously, Music Hall doesn't want to have to start its performances at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm certain that FC doesn't want to play its games at that time. I think they want to, you know, prime time is prime time for a reason. So, but maybe there's some scheduling. Maybe that's part of the compromise. We'll see.
What's it going to look like down here in this part of town when there is a soccer stadium and there's a game going on and there's an opera over at Music Hall? What kind of crowds can we expect? What type of traffic situation can we expect?
I think the traffic will be bad, but it'll be vibrant. It'll be good for the city.
You know, that does bring up yet another issue.
Right.
Liberty Street calming. Like, it's a main pathway into the stadium, and it's slated to be, you know, for calming measures that have been in the work for years.
Right.
You know, some people are afraid that's not going to happen now.
Just to understand what we're talking about there, Liberty Street would be narrowed to five lanes of traffic with after 7 p.m. going down to three with on-street parking. And the administration has really kind of dragged its heels implementing that, even though council's provided the funding and approved the thing. And there's a belief that FC wants that road to be as wide as it is, but they have denied that, as has the mayor. So that's up in the air as well.
And so, even the parking thing, even the mayor admitted during the council meeting on Wednesday night that parking on game days is going to be a problem.
Major problem is the word he used.
So it's not the only street, though. Liberty is not the only street that we're talking about this week.
Central Parkway.
Central Parkway. And there's a request from the team that it should be closed during game day.
Actually, to be clear, the administration and the team say that's a public safety matter, not something the team is requesting.
Okay.
Although there's people that don't believe that.
Well, sure. But so what's the reasoning behind that?
Safety
for people getting in and out. To and from the
people walking across the street in parades, as FC has typically done. The mayor said that I haven't checked this, so I have no idea whether the details of it. But the federal government requires some kind of bomb sniffing type of situation for major sporting events. So it's supposedly up to the police chief. There are five members of council that have signed a motion that says, administration, you should not be blocking off this street in front of the stadium before games.
There's a lot of concern for the neighborhood, and rightly so. And they're saying that it should remain open because they don't want to interrupt the neighborhood and disrupt things there. There's been promises that they'll be. That people going to games won't park in the neighborhood. I'm a little bit unclear how they're going to do that. But, I mean, minimal impact to the neighborhood, and council members are very cognizant of it. And it's at least they're saying it's coming up from that. This issue has arisen because of that issue alone.
You know, look, I think that the city is going to have to really be proactive at getting people to park, in downtown and in the garages and over the Rhine and walking and taking the streetcar and maybe even, God forbid, taking public transit to the stadium itself. That's just – if you plop a stadium in an urban neighborhood that's heavily residential, that's going to cause problems, and the city needs to do things to mitigate it. The fact of the matter is people are not going to be able to park right in front of this thing and walk across the street as they're able to do at Great American Ballpark and Paul Brown Stadium.
Unless you have a pass to park in our town center garage here.
Right.
No. That's a whole other story. Now we decided that wasn't true, like that you still won't be able to.
And but, it's really only – how many are in this garage?
I think there's 665 spaces, 660, something like that. Plus, the new service lot would be 67 spots, I think, so around 700, 750.
Right. 513-419-7100 if you want to weigh in. Talk at WVXU.org, Facebook, and Twitter as well. You think there's any buyer's remorse from the team for the West End? Are they looking back over at Newport and thinking, I don't think the fish at the aquarium would have been complaining about all this noise, that we could have moved over there a little more seamlessly? Is there any of that chatter?
I have no idea.
I don't think so. You know why? Because it's, first of all, Major League Soccer, did a lot of dictating about the idea that we needed our own stadium, because of course people are like, just use Paul Brown Stadium. But that came from them, right or wrong. And the most successful soccer stadiums are in the urban areas. And quite like, why would we build it somewhere where it's proven that that's not the best idea? And so I am always on people to be like, what are best practices somewhere else? And so, I mean, that's what they're saying about this. And I don't think there probably is buyer's remorse if they're going with that as their template.
Well, I think there was the optics of you didn't want FC Cincinnati in Northern Kentucky. Sort of like the Cincinnati Airport is in Northern Kentucky. I think it was just the optics that it had to be on the Ohio side.
This is what we talked about on our first show this week, was that weird relationship we have here in Cincinnati, this weird, odd relationship on both sides of the river, and a little bit of friendship, a little bit of resentment. So we talked a little bit about what the game day might look like if there's an opera night and a game night all at the same time. But just in general, what does this neighborhood look like after all this dust settles? Are these going to be good neighbors for each other? And I'm talking about the large organizations, the team, the ballet, music hall, those entities. Are these folks going to be able to get through this and be friends afterwards?
I think it depends on who you ask. The team says they're reaching out and doing all they can to be a good neighbor, and the people who are near now don't necessarily buy that this is going to be good for their neighborhood.
I think it remains to be seen. The folks in the arts community swear they're not trying to block FC from going to the West End. It's too late to do that anyway. If they wanted to do that, they should have said something 6 months ago or a year ago, I guess. So I think they're just going to have to grind through it and make it work.
And don't forget what it looked like before this. There's a lot of issues about pushing people out, and there's the ports getting involved and things like that. But for the most part, this footprint was a lot of vacant, crappy buildings, and there's been no investment in the West End for years, decades.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mary on the line. What do you want to say, Mary?
A couple of things. One is about lighting. I think some of the worst lighting in this country is around athletic fields. If you're really expecting people to live in those neighborhoods and deal with that kind of noise and lighting and, I don't know, the pictures I've seen on TV, they have orange smoke and banners and all kinds of things. Doesn't seem like a great place to have your family. And the other is about the demographics of the people who use these facilities. Frankly, I go to the symphony quite a bit and music hall and support them. And I don't know if you'll find, we're all pretty old and... I don't know that you'll find maybe six sets of good knees in the entire music hall. Lots of walkers and lots of us who need help with stairways and all of that. And we're not going to, we're grateful that we only have to walk across the street to park. I'm not going to want to walk 4 or 6 or 8 blocks to walk to get to the symphony.
All right, Mary.
And hope that I don't listen to the FC Cincinnati noise and the orange smoke drifting over the Washington Park.
Well, we wish you luck there.
That seemed very attractive.
Thank you, Mary, for that feedback. Appreciate it very much. Let's talk to Tom. What's your question, Tom?
Yes. I was just curious if Music Hall is worried about noise. Why not during the rehabilitation? Were they taking into account all the sound events and concerts and that over at Washington Park?
Well, so the answer...
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say 3CDC has a policy. 3CDC, of course, programs Washington Park. I believe their policy is not to have events like that in Washington Park during a performance.
And the other thing that was pointed out, the design and work on Music Hall was all done and completed before there was ever contemplated to be a soccer stadium a couple of blocks over from Music Hall.
All right, Jerry, you're next. What's on your mind?
How much is the city of Cincinnati investing in this stadium, and is there going to be any kickback as a result of our investment?
If you mean whether they're going to own a piece of it, that's no. They're spending $35 million on infrastructure and site preparation for the stadium.
I think that's an important point to clarify, because we do hear the team frequently say this is private investment, but there are public components in relation to the project. So what is the difference?
Moving utility lines, the county building a parking garage. There's
more than the $35 million, too. That's on top of it.
But there's no direct investment in building the stadium. It's the stuff that would support the stadium.
And frankly, a lot of developers would have to build their own infrastructure. I can't just say, I'm going to put a house in a cornfield, City of Cincinnati, give me some money. Not that we have any cornfields, but the point is the same.
If we did, we'd put the soccer stadium there.
We would.
We've got a few on the Kentucky side. All right, Carl, what's on your mind? Do we have Carl on the line? All right, well, we might come back to Carl. Okay, so moving on, and in the last couple of minutes that we all have together, the timeline for this project, and as it relates to some of these issues that the government has to deal with. Let's lay all this out one last time so that we know the timeline of the construction, but also the timeline of what may be happening next in terms of lawmakers voting.
I thought heavy duty construction was to start in the spring. And I believe they said if they keep the schedule that they have now, you would see concrete coming out of the ground, I think was the quote in May.
But I think, yes, yeah, that's true. But I saw something that said June, too. But I think your question was, where are we going with votes?
Well, that, too, yes.
So to get everything started, council has to approve planning commission plans and this land deal. And they're saying they have to come through at the same time.
And they will be separate votes. They won't be the same piece of legislation.
Correct. Yeah. Nothing can happen without either of those two votes. So we have to start there. And there's no real deadline for those things except what the team was hoping they'll do it right now. There's no, the city doesn't have to do it right this second if they don't want to.
But if there's some waffling, there's either going to have to be some heavy-duty negotiations between now and Monday, or perhaps Wednesday, or my guess is then we're going to be delayed a week, maybe 2 weeks.
And the committee vote is Monday for the land deal. The plan development is already through committee, and the final vote could come Wednesday, depending on whether there's a deal or not.
So then after this, it has to go back through Planning Commission, which that date is March 25th, for final approval of, like, design elements and, like, what this building is really going to look like. And so those are our key points that are coming up here.
Well, that's going to be a lot of fun to watch over the next week, and we'll be tuning in to all of you for that. Thank you to Jay, Chris, and Sharon for joining us. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The faculty strike at Wright State University continues, and now the issue has the attention of officials beyond the Fairborn campus. Here to talk about that is Dayton Daily News reporter Max Philby, who joins us on the phone. Welcome, Max.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So for those listening who are just catching up to this story, can you just give us a brief understanding of what is going on up there?
Sure. So today is day 18 of the faculty union strike at Wright State. Basically, the strike is continuing with one issue really still on the table, or one main issue still on the table. The issue of health care has kind of been up for debate still, and that seems to be why the strike has continued for so long.
And what are the differences between the faculty and the administration in relation to health care?
Sure. So the administration would like the faculty union to join a university-wide healthcare policy that already exists. With that would come the stipulation that the healthcare plan can be changed at the university's discretion, and they would have to give the union 60 days notice if they plan on changing it. That is actually why the union is strongly opposed to it. They say that it would take away their right to bargain over healthcare.
So what's going on with the students whose classes have the classes been canceled?
Sure. So it's really been a large mix. Before the strike had started, the administration had said that they plan to continue classes, just that some might be moved online or combined or taught by a substitute. But in the days since, we've seen that there have been a number of specialized classes, as the universities referred to them, that have been canceled simply because they can't find an instructor to replace the one that may be on strike. I was told that these might include very specific classes like Shakespearean literature and things like that.
So are they actively looking for, like, part-time or adjunct faculty members to come in and fill in during this strike?
Yes. So more recently, the university posted adjunct positions for temporary jobs on a number of job boards. They included, I think, 90 different disciplines, ranging from everything from, you know, the history of motion pictures to organic chemistry. So they're looking for a number of adjunct faculty who might be able to fill in on a temporary basis.
What's the student morale like on campus right now?
Sure. So it's kind of a mixed bag. There's several students who don't really know a whole lot about the strike other than that it's happening. But there's actually several students who are paying very close attention. Some students have been very upset. You know, I've talked to a few seniors who are graduating this spring who say, I'm not sure what I'm going to be doing because a class that is required for my major has been canceled. So they've been trying to seek answers in the last few days. There's also been a number of student protests, marches, sit-ins, all those sorts of things have been happening recently, too.
And we're not just talking about college students. We also have high school students who earn college credits at Wright State. What's their status?
Yeah, so the administration has said that they do not believe any of the College Credit Plus courses. Those are the classes that high school students can take to get both high school and college credit at the same time. The administration has said that they do not believe that those are impacted. But we've heard from a number of parents, especially, who have expressed some concern about how this might impact their students if this keeps going.
Governor Mike DeWine weighed in. What did he have to say?
Yeah, so the governor has said so far that he does not plan on taking any action as of yet. He's also essentially said that it would be probably inappropriate for him to announce publicly what his intentions might be when he decides, if he decides, to take any action.
Hey, Max, we appreciate you checking in with us on this issue.
No problem. Happy to do it.
We learned this week that Hamilton County Sheriff Jim Neal is facing a significant budget shortfall, and that could impact staffing. We discuss that now with WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner. Welcome, Tana.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so what did the sheriff tell us this week?
Well, he said that he's going to lay off 10 deputies from enforcement, so people that are out on the streets, some from in the court services, so people that, you know, get people back and forth into their court appearances and at the jail, and three from his administrative staff. Now, this announcement, he had this big press conference, and the county commissioners were a little bothered by this announcement. They said, you know, well, we didn't really know anything about it, but they also said that he was going to have the announcement. But they also said, you know, this shouldn't come as a surprise because the county has been talking about budget cuts and the sheriff has been talking about budget cuts. So while it is sort of alarming to hear 10 deputies are being laid off, not all that out of the blue.
Sheriff Neal had referenced budget cuts in December prior to this. But who are these deputies that are being laid off? I believe I saw that he mentioned that he's already told them, but is he looking at newer hires or senior hires, and where are they working in the county? Do we know those details?
They are, you know, sort of a first fired type of deal. So these are less seniority, and they had to go to make room. So the electronic monitoring program is being moved under probation. So that's 16 deputies that have to find new positions. So he's found spots for 10 of those deputies because they have more seniority. So he's still looking for room for six more to be moved. The reason he said he was announcing it now was because he's already notified the 10 that are being laid off so that they can use their vacation time. They can use their all the things that are coming to them by their contracts. They can use that up before March 21st.
What do we know in terms of public safety, how these layoffs can impact the greater county? A lot of the townships and such rely on this organization to provide law enforcement services.
Right. So the sheriff says we won't notice it, you know, all at once, but you might notice it over time. For example, the three townships that everybody's been talking about, Crosby, Whitewater, and Harrison, don't have police services. So, and they don't contract, like, for example, Anderson Township contracts with the sheriff's department to provide patrol cars out there. So those won't be affected because they're paying for their deputies. But these other townships that have, you know, maybe three officers assigned out there that are driving around and whatnot responding, maybe they are not going to be there if the sheriff said, I'm not going to leave a person out there if I need them elsewhere. You know, if those townships aren't paying for that service, then I need that person somewhere else.
Have there been any proposed solutions to this budget deficit?
Well, there was a tax levy that was proposed by county commissioners, and that got shot down. Now, that was a bit of a moment yesterday at the county commission when Commissioner Todd Portoon didn't say the word, you know, sales tax. That got bandied about, but he went on a bit of a rant about, you know, we had a potential solution and it went nowhere.
We had some services for a fallen sheriff's deputy in Claremont County. What can you tell us about that?
Well, they're getting ready. The procession is beginning soon to the graveside services. But the funeral this morning at the church was rather quick. In fact, it only lasted about a half an hour. It opened with the chaplain, you know, saying some words, a typical church type of words. And then the sheriff of Claremont County got up and I don't want to say bizarre. It was very emotional for him, but he just sort of talked from his heart. He was used a couple of colloquialisms that, you know, just made people sort of laugh. But he also said he didn't hold back when he talked about the man that's accused of killing Deputy Brewer. He said, you know, to that blankety blank sitting in my jail, screw you. So, you know, and he said he's devastated on behalf of the family, on behalf of all of the people in his department and everybody in the community.
Very emotional times there in Claremont County. Appreciate you talking about all these issues today, Tana.
You're welcome.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's turn our attention now to the Bluegrass State, where Governor Matt Bevin delivered his State of the Commonwealth in Frankfurt just this week, his first time doing so since becoming a candidate for re-election. So we're going to break down the governor's message with Courier Journal reporter Tom Loftus. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so I've heard about the governor taking a softer tone in this speech and avoiding conflict. So what did you notice that was different in what we would see previously from the governor?
Well, it was a lot different. It may be a sea change in sort of the governor's attitude in dealing publicly on issues and so on and so forth. And it was for this basic reason. The governor's often known to be combative or to really lay it on the line when it comes to issues like pension and taxes. And he was talking to a tough crowd last night. The Republicans run everything down here, the House and the Senate, but he had clashed with them quite bitterly at the end of December when they adjourned a special session he called to pass a pension reform bill, a bill that had been struck down by the Kentucky Supreme Court for procedural reasons. And on top of, I mean, he had called the Republican leaders of his own party, weak and giving hollow excuses for adjourning that session and not passing some pension reforms that he says will bring our pension liabilities in line. So he's been quite combative over the years, and he's and occasionally, in this case, with his own party people. But it was a very measured address by the governor. He emphasized accomplishments that he's had, and he's had many. Accomplishments, that is, if you're a conservative Republican, from that perspective, a lot of accomplishments. He accentuated the positive and didn't talk much about the negative. And he talked about the priority that all folks have down here of a school safety bill passing this session, and didn't really hammer on their differences on pensions. And it was, as they say, to use the cliche, a kinder and gentler Matt Bevin that spoke to the General Assembly last night.
Well, it seems a little strange that we would be talking about Governor Matt Bevin being softer after his comments about how soft school children are getting for staying home on snow days. So do you think he took any, did he learn anything from those comments and the pushback that he got?
You know, he's gone through these phases before where his comments have gotten him into his candor, his off-the-cuff remarks have gotten him into trouble. And certainly, perhaps, the one that got the most attention was the one a week and a half ago or so when on Louisville Radio he said, we're all getting too soft for calling off school because it's cold. And that was the first week since he filed for re-election. And, you know, it's often said down here that this race for governor is Matt Bevin's to lose. In other words, it's a race between Matt Bevin and his own mouth. Well, the score after week one was mouth one, Matt Bevin zero. And but this week, he's taken a different tack. The man is an amazing talker. He went on for 45 minutes, had a few notes because he was doing a PowerPoint at the same time, had images up on the screen.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that because I know Matt Bevin to be an interesting speaker. He is a skilled extemporaneous speaker. He's not someone who requires a fully written out speech, and he loves to just speak off the cuff, even when he's up here in our part of the world talking about this or that. But he had this slideshow going. I saw a lot of feedback on Twitter about this. So was this a unique presentation for a governor?
I believe it was. It wasn't all that surprising. You know, technology's come a long way since I started here decades ago. And there's the ability on the regular screens that display the vote count in the House to put up images, which he did. And he rattled through accomplishments, talked about some of the crises while talking about the school safety bill, for instance. He put up childhood photos, and then the more recent 15-year-old photos of the two Marshall County high school students who were shot in that tragic school shooting we had just about a year ago, while he was emphasizing the need for the school safety bill, which is one of the few things that he can get together with all members of the General Assembly on. He was particularly talking last night about issues that he and Republicans can unite on, sort of standard conservative bills. For instance, bills restricting a woman's ability to get an abortion. He talked about that issue for a while. So he was trying to talk unity, trying to talk accomplishments, and said really offered no new policy initiative.
Yeah, that's what I want to ask about next, because you're mentioning that he was talking about unity, and this was a kinder, gentler Matt Bevin, but this was also his first State of the Commonwealth as a candidate. He's running for re-election as governor. Did anything in the speech strike you as campaign-related, as something that he may be able to run on?
Well, the biggest surprise in the speech at all, to me, to avoid your question, but an important point, for a year and a half, the governor has been hammering that we need to change structurally our pension system. The governor, to his considerable credit, has offered budgets that were passed down here that put a lot more money into pensions. But he thinks structural changes are needed. In other words, changes to benefits. In other words, at least some modest tweaking and trimming for future employees, not current ones, of benefits and so forth. That is extraordinarily difficult to do. But the governor has been saying some of our pension plans down here will go, I mean, for months, on, particularly on conservative talk radio, but in community forums up there in northern Kentucky and around the state, has been saying these funds, which Democrats and a lot of experts strongly disagree with, he says some of them could go belly up within just a couple of years without structural reforms. He did not hit that issue. He did not demand, as he has in other times recently, that this pension bill he wants get passed in this legislative session that we're in right now. He did say it's urgent that we need to pass this in 2019, but he did not pressure those legislative leaders he's been so critical of. He did not pressure them at all to get moving on that bill and pass it this session, partly because it's not going to happen. They don't have the votes for it. They likely will. There's a working group working on it. They'll likely come up with something that could pass later this year in special session.
All right, Tom, we appreciate you calling in and chatting with us today. That's Courier-Journal reporter Tom Loftus. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our show can be found online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.